Go and have a seat, everybody. Left my glasses in my pants pocket under there. Sorry about that. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. As you can see, I am here in Carson City, and Justice Pickering and Senior Justice Gibbons, who are the other two participating on this case, are appearing from our Las Vegas courtroom today. Let me get going here. So our first case on the calendar today is case number 83316, Alfaro versus State. I'm sure you have experience, I know you do, on the how the clock works, but I'm going to be asking in a moment if you want to reserve any time for a rebuttal, and when I do that, just know that you each side gets 15 minutes, and however much time you say you need for a rebuttal, that just means that's when the yellow light comes on. If you keep talking and keep going, you're still using up the rest of your time. With that warning, are you ready to go?
Yes, we are.
Okay. All right. Why don't you come on up and tell me if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal.
And good afternoon. Michael Castillo, Nevada Bar Number 11531, and my colleague, Michael Becker, Nevada Bar Number 8765 at council table. I would ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, William Rene Alfaro.
Okay, great. Go ahead and begin then. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll start with a respectful inquiry. I am prepared to argue in full, but we did raise approximately 8 subpoints. If either Justice Kadish or Justice Gibbons or Pickering have a particular subpoint of emphasis that they want me to start with, I'm happy to start there if the court would prefer.
Why don't we start with the issues regarding admission of some evidence either under other bad acts or res justi?
Sure, of course. And with regard to that particular subpoint, Your Honor, it was our perspective that the court below erred by admitting the other bad acts, either under the test of Franks v. State, adopting United States v. LeMay, or under res justi because it unfairly prejudiced the defendant. And defense counsel is aware that under Franks v. State, it's a real tall hill for the defense counsel to climb because, you know, the court did find in Franks that it is allowed, and it's also essentially allowed under NRS 48.045 to prove the character and to show that they acted in conformity therewith. But it's our perspective that the evidence in Fernley was not related to the incident that allegedly took place in Reno, Nevada. And the other alleged prior bad acts, you know, including particularly the Soma pill and the alleged fishnet stockings, of which no evidence was offered, I would say that did not clear under Nevada case law the factors necessary, particularly the prejudice prong. And turning briefly to res justi, under the res justi statute, it is clear that the witness in question has to be the complete story of the case, and that they can't describe that without also describing the prior bad act as well. And we feel that the state, had that in there, but we don't think the burden was met, and we think that the witness in question clearly could have testified as to the alleged acts in question without talking about the alleged other prior bad acts. And I would also add, and this is not my moving papers, but in just preparing for this argument, that res justi, I would proffer, is essentially on its way out in some states. I don't have the citation right now, but I know from talking to my counterpart, Mr. Becker, my colleague, Mr. Becker, rather, that Colorado recently abolished the doctrine of res geste, and I believe Missouri did as well, and basically said that everything should still be subject to, you know, the prior bad acts analysis and under Franks v. State and 48.035 and 48.045. But I would submit that in this particular case, under res geste or under prior bad acts, that the burden was not met and the evidence should have been excluded.
So the court, it's my understanding that the district court admitted two of the acts under 48.045 because they have to have qualified under the statutory provisions as a prior sex offense. And I believe those two were the Soma pills and the photos. Is that your understanding?
That's counsel's recollection as well, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. And so there's no dispute, I don't think, that those acts would qualify as prior sex-related acts, offenses within the meaning of the statute. The dispute, I believe, is in the application of the factors and specifically the LeMay factors, or I guess under Franks.
That's correct, Your Honor. Under Franks or LeMay, and I think particularly the prong, you know, the necessity of that evidence coming in beyond the testimony already offered at trial or in hearings before then. And also just in terms of the similarity of the prior acts charge, I would submit that the Soma pill was generally unrelated, and I believe the testimony offered, I think the appellant did testify that he himself took Soma. I don't think there was any testimony from the appellant that he ever gave Soma to the alleged victim in this case.
Sure, but there was evidence presented that he had given her half or a whole Soma pill.
From her testimony, yes, Your Honor.
Right, okay. So would you agree then that if we're talking about the court's application of the factors under the case, and I guess whether it should have been admitted or not under that, we're talking about an abuse of discretion standard, right?
Yes, it is abuse of discretion.
How did the court abuse its discretion in admitting those acts?
I think, of course, brief indulgence. I think we essentially argued that it was abuse of discretion under Newman v. State because the admission of that evidence unfairly prejudiced the defendant from being able to have a fair trial. And the bottom line is the prejudice outweighed any probative value, due to the charges he already faced and the ability of the witnesses in question to kind of differentiate and talk about the primary case in question without talking about those other bad acts.
Okay. And as to the, I guess let's first talk about the fishnet stockings. So it's, that supposedly had occurred not at the hotel in Reno, which is where the charged acts took place, but instead, and is it Fernley?
Fernley, Nevada, yes.
Okay. And so what is the, I guess, what's the alleged prejudice from the admission of that piece of evidence?
I think the alleged prejudice would be that if the appellant, Mr. Alfaro, was accused of sexual misconduct with a minor under 14 and also lewdness under 14, you know, is the fact that he's allegedly having her wear fishnet stockings, is that perhaps considered to be unusual? Yes, but we don't punish people for being unusual. We punish people for whether or not they commit a crime. So I would say that was essentially a distraction for the jury as to the main event in question.
So let me ask this. If it wasn't appropriately admitted as res geste, okay, let's put that aside for a moment. If it was not appropriately admitted as res geste, was there any argument that it should be admitted for another purpose under 48.035? As, you know, as under the standard, if you will, other bad act statute that's used regularly.
And I think under that, it essentially comes down to what's the similarity of that to the X charge. And I would say that it kind of fails on that prong, that that's not a similar action.
No, but would it be some evidence of, for example, motive, intent, absence of mistake or accident, those sorts of things under 48035?
And I know that those are the standard ones that a court, and I believe the trial court looked on that one as well.
Yeah. Okay.
If it's helpful to the court, there were a couple subpoints that I did want to raise with regard to jury instructions.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. And that essentially was subpoint number 6, set forth on page 28 through 30 of our opening brief. And what I'll focus for the court's attention is the argument that took place, the respectful argument that took place between ourselves and the state in terms of whether or not an additional jury instruction with regard to the definition of lewdness should have come in. And we essentially argued that the lewdness statute spoke for itself, NRS 201.230 spoke to itself, and we argued that by the state asking for Berry v. State to come in, that was above and beyond the lewdness statute as to what he was actually charged, because Berry v. State actually talks about the open and gross lewdness, and that sexual conduct that's obscene or indecent, tend to moral impunity or wantonness, as opposed to the lewdness statute. And we feel that it unfairly prejudiced our client, because the lewdness statute requires a touching, but arguably the open and gross lewdness does not require a touching. And by essentially adding, you know, the language of obscene or indecent, tending to moral impunity or wantonness, we felt it essentially lowered the burden for the state, because it essentially muddied the water, so to speak.
So one of the elements of the lewdness with a child under 14 is, as set forth in instruction 20, the second element was commits any lewd or lascivious act. And of course it goes on, and there's other parts of the requirement there. But why is it error to include a definition of what lewdness is when he's required to have committed a lewd or lascivious act?
And I think the answer to that is, this Supreme Court, and it's a 1974 case, but it is generally on point. And I'll just find it for the court.
Sure. I mean, while you're looking, I guess, the rest of element 2, which is in instruction 20, said, commits a lewd or lascivious act upon or with the body or any part or member thereof. But I guess I come back to, why is it error to define lewdness?
Right. And I would say it's error because had the Nevada legislature under statute wanted to specifically define lewdness as to lewdness with a minor under 14, they would have done so. But in basically taking Berry v. State and also the state's unpublished opinion of Hogarth v. State, they're basically trying to piggyback the open and gross, what I would say is a more broad definition, onto the lewdness statute. And there is plenty of case law in point which basically says that these terms have their because these terms have their ordinary well understood meaning, we don't need to generally expand on this. And I think this was an unjustified expansion in this case.
You want to reserve the rest of your time?
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Noble and I represent the state of Nevada. Like Mr. Castillo, I'll begin with the issues he started with, unless the court directs me otherwise. I believe the first issue he touched upon had to do with the other act evidence that was admitted under the doctrines of res gestae and also under NRS 48-045-3. So I'll begin with that res justi analysis, and I would first begin by saying that I would ask this court to decline any invitation to follow whatever Colorado has done. We have our res justi statute in Nevada, 48-035-3, and that is part of Nevada law.
Okay, but how does putting up fishnet stockings on her some period of time earlier that wasn't even in Reno, you know, before they moved to the Reno location, how is that something that they can't describe the acts at issue in the charges without discussing that? That's what the standard is.
Well, thank you for the question, Justice Kadish. And I would submit to you that at the time that this abuse occurred, this child was between 9 and 10 years old. And the story of how she first came to essentially live with the defendant is relevant and necessary to present the full and accurate account of the circumstances in which this child found herself and the story of the crime. It's relevant to the grooming process, how the abuse began, and how he normalized
But res justi isn't just you can bring in anything that's relevant. It's a specific statute that governs other acts where you just can't describe the acts that are charged without including these other things. Isn't that the standard?
That is the standard, and here's why what the state did meets that standard. Here we have a child victim who's explaining how this person wore her down, how he normalized sexual behaviors, how he objectified her sexually, showed her pornography, and did all these other things. The location, I don't think, is very relevant because it's still pretty close in time to the 2015 events that we're talking about that happened in Reno. Here, her preliminary hearing testimony was clear that this was how he gained access to her through her parents' homelessness. He normalized these behaviors. He gave her soma to facilitate that abuse. And by the way, there was a stipulation on the record that he had a prescription to soma. Right. He made her look at pornography, had her wear fishnets, taking photos of her in various states of undress.
Right.
So although this is prejudicial to the defendant, it doesn't mean that it's inadmissible. And although we're talking about that, that's actually not applicable under State versus Shade, that probative versus prejudicial analysis. But even if the court disagrees with that, which I'm looking at.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, it's not the same weighing process as other bad acts under other provisions, but isn't all evidence that's admitted ultimately potentially subject to being unduly prejudicial?
Certainly it is, but we have to look at, does the relevance outweigh the prejudicial effect? And simply because it's prejudicial doesn't make it inadmissible. Here it's highly relevant because it explains why she didn't report for so long, how this happened to her, how these behaviors were normalized for her at a tender age while this defendant had the opportunity to access this vulnerable child.
But this is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas, but to credit your position, you're essentially saying all grooming would come in. Because your argument, as I understand it, is that the fishnet stockings and having her watch pornography and the nude pictures of her, that all of that explains why these acts occurred, and then later she didn't immediately report them to anyone. But it strikes me that it is terribly prejudicial. And so you're looking at that balancing process because he's not charged with those acts.
Thank you for the question, Justice Pickering. And my response to that would be, my position is not that all grooming evidence comes in. But here we have, in a relatively short period of time before the family is in the Gateway Inn in Reno, these acts happening. And they explain not only how it predisposed her to acquiesce or to sort of have these acts normalized, but also they're relevant to some of his admissions. Remember, he admits in his interview, which is Exhibit 43, that he told the victim he was attracted to women in fishnet stockings. And so it actually goes right into the evidence that's admitted at trial from his own statements.
Well, even if it's relevant, though, how does that mean that she can't describe what happened at the hotel in Reno without mentioning the fish. I mean, she actually did describe what happened in Reno without mentioning the fishnet stockings until she was asked about them.
Thank you for the question, Justice Kadish. I would simply say that even if this court doesn't find it was proper res gestae evidence, which the state believes it does, we also have 045 sub 3 of that same section. That unambiguously allows the admission of similar sexual bad acts for propensity evidence. It is relevant to show his character, his propensity for sexual aberration, showing the victim pornography, medicating her to reduce her resistance to these initial.
So would showing her, and this is truly a question, would showing her porn or having her put on the fishnet stockings, does that come within one of the defined sex offenses within the scope of that statute? I just don't know offhand.
Well, I would say that it's prior sexual bad acts. Right, so if we have a man who's just saying he's attracted to women in fishnet stockings in his interview and he's putting them on a 9-year-old, right, then I would say it falls squarely within that province. The same with the pornography. It's normalizing the sexual behaviors, showing a 9-year-old images rather of people having anal sex, having all kinds of sex, is certainly bad acts of a sexual nature. I don't know that it requires an actual sexual assault or crime, but certainly it falls squarely within that statute. And it's relevant, of course, again, to grooming, which is admissible under Perez. And we had Dr. McLeod testify in this case. The expert testified about grooming behaviors and how what the victim described was certainly relevant, or was certainly consistent with grooming behaviors designed to normalize these sexual behaviors for a child. The record also reflects that in its analysis, especially with respect to 045 sub 3, that the court did consider the victim's preliminary hearing testimony, considered the relevance of this evidence, the prejudicial effect of it, and found that a reasonable jury could find by a preponderance of the evidence that this conduct did occur. It explicitly goes through the Franks and LeMay factors, similarity to the charged acts, closeness in time, frequency, lack of intervening circumstances, necessity, etc. And it's necessary, again, to explain how these sexual behaviors were normalized, how they're consistent with grooming, but also I would invite the court to look at the district court's analysis, which is at volume 1 of the record, pages 208 to 214. Mm-hmm. And I would also state that in light of the wealth of evidence in this case, including the victim's testimony, statements to other people, and the defendant's own admissions, any error would be harmless with respect to the admission of this res gestae or alternatively prior sexual act evidence. Moving to the issue of the lewdness instruction, it's true that we don't have a whole lot in Nevada regarding the definition of lewdness in the context of a lewdness with a minor case. However, the state in this case relied on a definition that was consistent with Berry, and the standard of review is, of course, an abuse of discretion. I would also note that fairly recently in 2017 in Shue versus State, there's still a recognition by the court, and that's at 133 Nevada 798, that there is a discrete definition in Berry. It's also recognized in Hogarth. In Berry, of lewdness and the open and gross portions of that. So that's what we've got in Nevada. And in this case, given the state of the law, this district court certainly did not abuse its discretion in giving that jury instruction.
Can you
talk about a question that's discreet about count 11,
yeah,
which charges Alfaro for kissing the child on the mouth? And whether or not, to the extent that's charged as lewdness, that actually the only evidence where she testifies he kissed her was part of an assault. And it's concerning to me whether or not it's redundant under the redundancy cases that we have.
Yes, so the state's position would be that it is not actually redundant, and here's why. There are some cases where a kissing is found to be not redundant or not lewd behavior. But here is what the victim testified to. She said that...
Where are you in the record?
Thank you. We are at volume 2, pages 279 to 280.
Okay, and we're in the same place.
Okay, great. So she says that after he digitally penetrates her in her vagina, that he has her turn her head to kiss him. And so it's not redundant because it's not simply part of something that was necessary to complete the sexual act. It's not like Gaxiola or Crowley where we have people touching little boys' penises to predispose them to fellatio or as a prelude to the fellatio act. The sexual assault's already complete at the time the lewdness occurs.
So, like, during the sex act, while he is digitally penetrating her, he has her turn her head and does a French kiss, is what her testimony is. She doesn't say, like, he took his fingers out of her vagina at that time. Like, so is it your position that if there's a kiss during the sex, that that's a separate lewdness count?
Yes, it is our position, because here, this isn't something that's just a touching of a penis like Gaxiola or Crowley, where it's incidental to fellating a child. Here we have a digital penetration that may have just occurred or is ongoing. Separate and apart from that, this little girl who he has previously put a pillow over her face, he has her turn her head and makes her kiss him. This was not a consensual kiss. And so I think in the context of this case...
I'm certainly not trying to defend that.
And Justice Cage, I would never think that. And I'm sorry, I'm just passionate about this case.
I understand.
But I would argue on the specific circumstances to which the victim testified that this should be seen separately. And when we're talking about redundancy and we're talking about the other lewdness counts, touching of the child's breasts, her buttocks, her vaginal area... remember that in the defendant's interview, which was admitted, again, as Exhibit 43, from about an hour and 45 minutes in to an hour and 52 minutes, he admits to all this. And I apologize for my Malay language here, but he says, oh, I pinched her titties and I grabbed her ass. He's talking about a 9-year-old child. And so,
he doesn't seem to think there was anything wrong with doing so.
Yes, clearly. And so it would be the state's position that part of what supports... or actually doesn't support the redundancy arguments in this case, is that he actually testified to them. And in her testimony, she talks about different acts and different times they occurred. And if the court is concerned about the sufficiency of the evidence regarding any of the other counts, I've got about 1 minute and 30 seconds left, but I've got lots with regard to each count.
Let me just quickly ask whether or not, other than the volume 2, 279 to 80, do you have any other evidence where she testified to a separate act of kissing other than the one that was tied to the sexual assault?
Justice Pickering, my notes, there may be something in the record. This is a fairly large record with a number of sexual acts, but mine just reflect that 279 to 280 description by the victim.
Okay, so that's the only such reference you have at hand?
Yes.
And that's what was argued to the jury about count 11, right, as the basis for count 11.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much, Justice Kadish and Pickering.
I want to follow up then very briefly in a different area. There's arguments being made that the court's comments at sentencing were inappropriate or indicate some error. Can you address that issue?
I'll try to do it in 30 seconds.
There you go.
So there is a comparison of the court's comments at sentencing with Denson, but that's an apposite. In Denson, we have a judge tell somebody, I believe every time you walked into a casino, you meant to steal something. Every time was a burglary, and I'm going to punish you for, quote, all those other times. Here, that's not what the judge said. He said that this was a crime against all little girls. He didn't actually mean that he believed, it's clear from the record and the context, that he had actually assaulted, quote, all little girls.
You can finish your thought.
Thank you. Instead, he's commenting on the impact of the crimes on society in general and the reluctance of victims to report. Because remember, in this case, he told her that if she reported, she would be put in foster care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Castillo.
And with the court's permission, I'll start with the last point that the state made. And if you look at page 39 of the state's reply brief, they actually expand on that quote from the Judge Breslow above and beyond what I put in. And I'm glad they did, because not only did Judge Breslow say crimes like this are crimes against all little girls, he goes on to say they're against society. Couple of sentences down, some crimes just transcend the actual people involved. And I would say that is classic Silksby State, where he's basing his decision based on impalpable or highly suspect evidence. And Denson was the closest case I could find generally on point, where in Denson, the judge said, I'm punishing you not just for what you did then, but for all the other times that you've done a bad act. And keep in mind, in that case, the state asked for, I believe, 45 years. We asked for the minimum, which was 35, and he got in excess of 200 years. And we believe that was absolutely an abuse of discretion. Real quick, in the minute 23 I have left, unless there's any additional questions, I'll just go back to another couple points. I think the vest gestae thing is absolutely crucial, in that there's plenty of case law, including, I believe, Bellin v. State, which stands for the proposition that you got to be able to establish that they cannot describe the prior bad act without also incorporating that into the original accusations. Clearly, fishnet stockings, pornography, the witness would have been able to testify to it. With regards to the state's point that it comes in under Franks v. State, or Franks v. State still requires a Petrocelli analysis. I would submit that they would not meet the prejudice prong. And in the 37 seconds, I'll also mention this. There's also prejudice here, because that evidence came in, and then they had an expert on grooming testify. So that pretty much adds to the prejudice when you had a grooming witness testify, incorporate the fishnet stockings. I think it's clear that he could have not gotten a fair trial with that evidence.
Doesn't that show the relevance of the evidence, the fact, the concept of grooming and how it plays into sex abuse of a child?
But I don't think fishnet stockings is grooming. Grooming is taking you out for ice cream. 3 seconds left. I've done other arguments here.
Finish your sentence.
Sorry. There's other arguments that I made. I would ask the court to also consider those in full. And I thank you for the court's time.
Thank you very much. All right. This matter will stand submitted.